Committee Personnel Pension Insurance Committee special meeting of Tuesday, March 9th. Public comments relative to agenda items. Approved. We have a motion for the approval of the minutes of February 28th, 2020.
So moved.
Second.
Second.
Any additions, corrections, or changes? Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Number four, pension plan investment performance. David, before you start, I see Chris Martin's on the call, and I want to thank Chris for the last year and a half, 2 years that he's been with us, keeping the committee well informed of what's going on, and working with David and making sure these meetings were called on a quarterly basis. And I'd just like to thank you, Chris, for your hard work.
Well, thank you, Commissioner, and I want to thank this board, this group. It's this has been a great group to work with, and we're lucky to have good professionals engaged here between David Lee and Milliman. It feels like we've been well served, so thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Chris. David, you want to start?
Great. Yes, I will. Thank you. I assume everyone has the presentation?
It is online, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, great. What I'm going to do is I'll just touch on several pages. If you all can flip to page 4, which is on the PDF 5 of 113.
Yeah, go ahead.
And as you all know, this really captures what happened from October, November, December of last year. So what I'll mention here is in that upper left-hand corner of the page, you see that GDP for the fourth quarter came in at 4%. It's since been revised up slightly to 4.1. The previous quarter, as you see, was 33.4%. And really what that is a sign of what's happened with COVID. You had the closures, obviously, and then some of the subsequent reopenings, as well as then forward-looking of how that would then improve GDP. So there's a lot of volatility with that. Now, currently, we're looking at probably somewhere between a 6% to a 10% type of annualized growth pace. So although different parts of the country are opening up a little bit different slowly, it looks like on a forward basis, we're going to get back into a growth stage for the economy. The other thing that is of note is that second row, the unemployment line, which shows the most recent recorded here number is 6.7. Since this point in time, unemployment's tracked down a little bit more, now in the lower 6.2 type of range. You see that it's trended better, but there is a caveat there, and the caveat being that, of course, there still are roughly 10 million people who are unemployed today compared to where we were this time last year. So prior to COVID, you had more employment. The areas that have suffered the most have primarily been service-oriented, so hospitality, leisure, travel, different types of restaurants, so and retail. So unfortunately, we have seen some take back there, but the hope is that as we start reopening, things will improve. What you have heard is this quote-unquote K-shaped recovery, if you will. So for those that are unfortunately unemployed or underemployed, they have suffered through COVID. However, for those that are gainfully employed and have a retirement account, the equity markets have bounced back tremendously. So if you look in the upper right-hand corner of the page and you see that first column, stocks rebounded nicely. The second row is the S&P 500, which represents large cap stocks, and that was up over 12% for the quarter, bringing the 12-month return to over 18%. What's even more impressive is that if you look a couple rows below that, the Russell 2000, which represents small cap stocks, were up over 30% for the quarter, bringing the 12-month return to about 20%. And that over 30% return for the quarter is something that is unprecedented for small caps. It really was a bounce back, and you saw markets do very well for the quarter. If you look towards the bottom of the page, bottom of those rows, you see the Nate Creek Odyssey, which is real estate, institutional quality real estate, and that was pretty much flat for the year. And bonds were up fractionally for the quarter and up about 7.5% for the year. So this is a year where, despite all the volatility that we had, was actually quite a very good year for the financial markets, where stocks and bonds both rebounded tremendously. The other thing I'll highlight here is the bottom left-hand corner of the page, just because it's a little bit different. You'll see that square that says value, core, and growth. And you'll notice that for the quarter, value outperformed core, outperformed growth. And in fact, the place that did the best was small cap value. I'm still on page 4. And if you look at the bottom left-hand corner of the page, you see a square that says VALCORGRO.
Mm-hmm.
And all I'm highlighting for you is that the first column, which is value, outperformed core, outperformed growth. So stocks that are more economically sensitive and the ones that are quote-unquote cheaper tended to do better for this recent quarter, which was different from what we saw for the trailing year, which is that second square. You see for the trailing year, that last column, GRO, which is growth, outperformed core, outperformed value, which is the trend that we've seen for several years. Anything that was growth-oriented did well. So all the technology stocks, primarily, the ones that you've all heard about, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Alphabet, which is Google, et cetera, they had done quite well for the fourth quarter. Now, as we sit here today, there is some volatility and rotation that we have seen within the past week, but at least for this quarter, value did better. I'm going to ask you to flip page 9 for me.
What was that?
Page 9, which is 10 of 116, and on the top, they'll say performance summary. And this is a snapshot of the performance of the fund across different trailing periods. So I'm going to go through that first row and then come down the first column. So for the first row, you see the quarter gain for the fund was 13.1% on a gross basis, 13% on a net basis, ranking in the fifth percentile. And as you recall, the lower the number in parentheses, the better, meaning that with a 13.1% return for the quarter, this fund outperformed 95% of the other public funds out there. I think what's even more instructive is that second row, 13.0 is the net return. Shadow index is 12.0 and policy index is 11.7. As a reminder, the shadow index is if we had the money that we had just invested in index funds, that's the return that the fund would have gotten, which is 12%. If we had put it in the asset allocation with index funds as dictated by the investment policy, we would have gotten 11.7%. So the takeaway here is that for the quarter, even after fees, the portfolio did better compared to the shadow and the policy. So good allocation effect and good selection effect, meaning the active managers contributed and our over-allocation and under-allocation to asset classes helped with the performance. If you look at longer-term numbers, 3, 5, and 10-year performance of 9.7, 11.5, and 10.7 on a gross basis, all rank in the top quartile, if not the top decile. But again, takeaways, if you look at those net of fee returns exceeded both the shadow and the policy indices. And as a reminder, both the shadow and policy indices are actually gross of fees. So you would have to take away some basis points or at least 0.3% each in order to get it more in line to get a net-to-net apples-to-apples type of comparison. So the portfolio did very nice for the quarter as well as for the longer periods. Coming down the first quarter, first column to see how we did for that quarter, the reason why we performed well is most of the pieces did nicely. So large cap was 12.5 versus the bogey at 12.1, beating it. Mid cap is an index fund, so you expect to just meet the index, which is kind of what it did well. Small cap did very well, beating the benchmark by 4%. International also did very well, beating the benchmark by over 3%. Real estate did trail a little bit. Timber was flat, and bonds were up as well as 1.5 versus the bogey at 0.7. So overall, very nice quarter. The asset allocation in the upper right-hand corner of the page. So when you add up all those numbers there, roughly we were 69% in stocks across different flavors of stocks, domestic, international, large, mid, small. And then the rest of the money was either in bonds or bond surrogates. So we had money in real estate, timber, and fixed income and cash. We started the quarter, bottom right-hand corner of the page, at $227 million and change. We took out about $4 million and change, primarily for benefits, yet really the markets drove the performance up to a market value of $252 million and change. So nice performance overall. Any questions with this page? Great. If I could ask you to go to the next page then, I'm sorry, was there a question? I think there may be one person, but he's on mute.
Keep going.
Okay, great. So page 10. Page 10, you'll notice.
Commissioner Patel, you're muted. You need to unmute yourself.
Yeah, I unmuted myself. Mr. Chairman, through Mr. Chairman Ray, if we get this earlier, so we are not an expert as you are. So I want to go through it, understand, and ask question to David before we start the meeting. So for future, please have this sent earlier. And David, if you can give me your phone number, I'll call you, and I have question. I want to understand certain things. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, sure. If I could ask you to look at page 10. And page 10 is a snapshot of the corpus of the fund over the past 10 years. So you'll see that dark line is how the fund has increased in portfolio value. And what you'll notice is that it's trended from about $145 million to where it is today, $252 million. So it grew by roughly $100 million, even though we took out about $88 million. And all that's depicted in the black and white bottom right-hand corner of the page. The beginning market value was $145 million. We took out about $87 million. But really, the performance was outstanding. It made over $194 million, which is why we appreciated by about $100 million. As a reminder, the dotted hash line right in the middle of the page is the assumption rate. So had the fund gained the assumption rate for the past decade, that's where the fund market value would have been. It would have been about $173 million. And then the dotted line going to the south represents cash flows. So obviously, this is a more mature plan, and therefore, it's cash flow negative, paying off its obligations. What I will highlight also is that there was obviously some volatility with the stock market overall, as indicated by the fourth quarter of 2018 and the first quarter of 2020. And despite the drawdowns there, you've seen that the portfolio recouped that and has kept on appreciating over the long term. So it's going in the right direction over the long term.
Okay, thank you.
Great. I just want to hit on one more page. Page 11, and this is a decomposition of the returns that we just saw a moment ago on page 9. So what you see here is that we have multiple pieces for our equity components as well as for our real estate and fixed income. The takeaway here is that large cap is broken out into two managers, AQR and Wellington. AQR is a little bit more value oriented, so they have been a little bit more challenged, while Wellington has done nicely there over our long period. Rumline and Wellington small cap are the individual allocations for those two asset classes. So it's the same thing that we just saw a moment ago. And then international, you have two components, Hardman Johnson and Lazard. Lazard also is a little bit value oriented, while Hardman Johnson is growth oriented. So as you see, Hardman Johnson has done a fantastic job. And then our three real estate allocations, they performed nicely over the long term. And then our two fixed income allocations, they've also done nicely over the long term. So the takeaway here is that it was a very nice quarter overall, continuing the outperformance over the long term. What I will say is at the end of the year, the portfolio was $252 million. At the end of February, the portfolio was $254 million. Despite paying out several millions of dollars in pension obligations. So it continued to appreciate.
David.
Yes.
On that point, Scott, are you on the call? Scott. Okay. Maybe John, I don't know. Chris, you're not going to be here. So, John, you still there? Myrtle?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here, guys. Sorry. I'm trying to get
okay,
myself.
You're there, okay, now give it to Scott. At our next meeting, probably sometime, let's see, the quarter's over the 31st. Give David 4 to 6 weeks, March, April, middle of April, middle of May, I mean, April, May, the end of April, early May. Could we have Becky in? Because, hey, Scott, your picture's on there.
I know, huh?
I've like seen that. You before.
I know.
Okay, but can we have Becky come in the same meeting that David comes in at the end of the first quarter, and you know, 6-7 weeks after the quarter's over? Because David just said, I mean, we made $60 million
last year,
approximately. But it all comes down to Becky's numbers. Because last year in Becky's report, January 2020, we had $219 million in assets. The key is here, it's not what our assets are, it's what our liabilities are. And Becky will give us those numbers. Because as of last year's, I believe the Gatsby report, it shows that we were 72% funded. Now, so I want those numbers from her, this year's numbers. So we know what our exact, how much we were funded at the end of the year, this year. Yep. You know, are we up to 80%? Even though our pension grew by $60 million in value, how much did our liability go up? And she usually gives us a report once a year on that.
So, yes, we'll definitely do that.
You know, it's no time soon. It would be, say, 6 weeks after the quarter's over on March 31st. The other thing is, Scott, if you're still here, do you know when, or maybe Chris Martin, when we approximately make our yearly contribution, the MDC, the budgeted amount to the pension fund?
Chris Martin, do you have that date?
Wow.
Were you asking for the date of the valuation?
When do we usually, the MDC, make their contribution, whatever the budgeted amount is for this year, to the pension fund? So we see like $6 million going in or whatever the number is.
Yes, we typically make that payment in April, Commissioner, and sometimes it'll vary depending on our cash.
Okay, so probably in the second quarter, when we get the end of our second quarter report, we'll see the inflow of that money coming in.
Don't we do it on a quarterly basis, Ray?
That's what I'm asking, staff.
We don't. It doesn't happen quarterly. It's usually in the beginning part of the year that we make the – this is the district's contribution. The employees' contributions come in each month.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You're right.
But our budgeted amount usually comes in April. Money.
Scott? Okay. Scott?
Yes.
Since Chris isn't going to be there, if you look at Becky's report from Milliman, there is a significant jump in administrative expenses, particularly when you look at the expenses for 19 and 20 and then look for 21. Can someone explain that to us, please, at some point in time? Not now, but when someone from Milliman comes in.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And when Becky comes in, we've finalized, as you know, we're using Becky Seelman to do full pension services and calculations now. So we'll have them give you an update on that. We've presented to you on that numerous times at PP&I. So we will definitely have an update from her on that. But yes, I will absolutely ask her the admin services. There has been
one increase was remember we hired her to do the evaluations of the pension when people retired.
Yes, so that's what I'm referring to. Yeah, but there was a credit back to us because of how they charged in the past for the part. They were doing portion of the process, and HR was doing the rest. Now they're doing 100%. Kelly Shane, I know you're on. I think Kelly's on. I don't know what that dollar amount is that we're paying them.
Well, I just
something thousand.
I just have that those numbers laid out for us so we can see what we're paying. That's all.
Yeah, absolutely. Kelly, what are we paying Milliman to do the full services on the retirement pension?
Yeah, it comes to about $7,000 or $8,000 a month. It's a per member per month fee. And so we budgeted about $100,000 for this year. But Becky also has been doing the calculations. And like Scott said, now that we have the full pension administration being done by her firm, some of the costs that Becky charged us individually for pension calculations goes away.
Yeah, so there's a
college back. Wasn't it more like $70,000, the number she gave us? For the year?
That was 2 years ago. We had some implementation fees and things, so the total budgeted amount was about 100.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. But to the commissioner's question, we will definitely have her in to outline
is your
those.
OPEC, is your OPEC money put in the same time, basically, in the OPEC fund? As your pension money is put into the pension in April or so?
I can explain that. Typically, up until last year, you know, OPEB was completely pay-as-you-go. So we would get medical bills, insurance bills for retirees, and simply pay those when we got the bill. Now, we're in the position that we're in with the pension, where we have a portion that will be advance funded. Now, we have already, because you appointed Wilmington as custodian, we've moved the 2020 contribution, which had been segregated at Webster Bank, is now at Wilmington. And the 2021 contribution, we should be able to take that along with the pension payment in 2021. I mean, I'm sorry, before April, we should be able to make that contribution.
Okay, thank you. And then, David, you'll also be investing that money for us.
Yes. It's along the lines of what we already discussed. I believe the asset allocation is 65% large cap, 35% fixed income. So it will just go into the Vanguard, respective Vanguard funds. And we've talked with Diana about that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. David?
Yes.
David?
Yes, Al.
I guess this is a kind of general question. I mean, you look at the market and you look at what's going on both domestically and on an international level. I mean, most economies are shut down in a sense, and particularly with regard to the consumer sector, but also you know, I find it puzzling in terms of, you know, look at things like commercial real estate and industrial. I mean, commercial real estate, it seems like everybody's trying to figure out the, you know, the department stores are, you know, look like they're fading away. What's going to happen to the huge malls and things like that? This growth of the market, I mean, is it based on what? I mean, is on expectation or you right. know, just sort of exuberance? I mean, it's because I mean, you sort of look at it and it's puzzling because
sure.
they're just
and you also have to remember
thin air or what.
Right. No, and that's a fair question. And I think we're all kind of in the same boat along those lines, because if you think about how we in the Northeast are, you go outside, everyone's wearing a mask. And everyone has to follow certain social parameters as it relates to gatherings. But when you go to some other parts of the U.S., there are places where, yes, you may have to wear a mask going into stores, but you're outside. The weather is 30, 40 degrees, if not 50 degrees warmer than us, and people aren't wearing masks. And business has gone back to similar pace to where it was prior to COVID. And as you know, in fact, there are a couple of states that have now mandated no restrictions at all. So, yes, part of it sounds a little bit counterintuitive because of what the environment that we all live in the Northeast.
Okay.
But also, the markets are forward-looking, and it looks like there are a lot of positives in the future, meaning reopenings will happen. This time last year, we had no vaccines. As we sit today now, we have 3 approved vaccines in the U.S. We don't talk about the approved vaccines outside the U.S., but as you know, China has several vaccines. Russia has another vaccine. Europe is purchasing those vaccines as well as trying to purchase our vaccine. So there are signs and indications that there will be improvement. Additionally, there is a lot of stimulus both in our economy as well as economies throughout the world, which is why there was concern potentially of inflation that is percolating in the system. But all of this is forward-looking. So we may not feel the full effects here today, but they are coming.
Okay.
David, I have one question. If you look at page 8, large cap, we're, as far as our targeted summary of where we should, you know, allocate our money.
Yes.
Large cap, we're right on 10.2, 10%, 26, 20.5 to 20. When we get down to real estate, it seems like we're a little low there. 2.5% or 2.6 with Intercontinental to a 5% target, 1.1 to a 2.5, 1.5 to a 2.5.
Yes.
I mean, there are real estates that are doing good also.
Right.
I mean, there's some companies that are really doing good in real estate, and some of your home prices are going tremendously and stuff. Are we underweight in, do you feel, in any of these sectors? Whether, well, timber, we're a little under, but that's fine because we don't seem to be doing that good. But, you know, as far as international, small cap, mid cap, large cap, real estate, do you feel our allocations are still where they should be, or should there be some adjustments, or you're happy with what we...
What I'll say is that our allocation is within guidelines, so we're comfortable that way. However, what we've been doing, as you recall, is whenever we've had to raise money in order to pay off benefits, we've raised it from places that have been over-allocated, which has primarily been from stocks. The reason why large cap is on target right now is towards the tail end of last year, we raised $8 million from large cap in order to pay the benefits, and then large cap came back up to get to right to target. And you're absolutely right. The place that we are the most underallocated is real estate. Part of that was because, as you all recall, we did have the land piece in the fund not so long ago. And because the combination of those two pieces got us to actually a little bit over target, we intentionally left this piece here a little bit below target. But that is one place that I think we could put some money to work. I think the ideal place would be taking the money away from places that are a little bit over allocated to target. Right now, that's primarily small cap and international, and then putting that to work in real estate. So the numbers come out to roughly about 5 or 6%-ish that we're under target to real estate and a little over target to equities. So I think that might make sense.
Okay. David, what are you telling or saying to your clients about what is it, the Bitcoin business, or what's the thinking there? I'm just out of curiosity.
Yeah. Sure. Well, first off, as you all know, this is an opportunity for me to say that as we sit here and talk today, we take the hat off of the regular retail investor and then put on the hat of the institutional investor, right? So those two are very different mindsets.
Yep.
Having said that, the challenge with Bitcoin, first off, is that there really is no regulatory body that oversees Bitcoin.
Yep.
Because what is Bitcoin? Some people consider
Wild Bitcoin, West.
It is a Wild West, yes. That's a good way of categorizing it. Some consider it a commodity. Others consider it a currency. There really is no definition of what Bitcoin is. Obviously, the underlying technology is blockchain, and that is the commonality amongst different types of currencies. But it's a little bit challenging yet to have this as an asset class, and it hasn't become fully institutionalized. It has been somewhat sensationalized, though, because the price of Bitcoin has increased multifold within the past 6 months.
Yep.
You know, you're looking at something that was trading below $10,000 less than a year ago, and now it's trading over $50,000 again. And it's just crazy valuations going up and down. Essentially, though, the reason for that is the technology itself is capped, and therefore, once you get to that limit, you just have to be able to buy it from somebody else. But it really has no oversight yet, and therefore, it's a little bit tough to get your arms around.
David, back. I'm sorry, David. Back to your point. You think we may be a little underweight in real estate. What kind of would you be if we were to make those changes and say where we're a little overweight in small cap in the Wellington fund, a couple percent there, or if we did the international funds where we're 2.5% overweight there. If we were to authorize the money to be taken from those funds, say, would you be putting it into Cornerstone and Intercontinental, or would you be looking at a new, different kind of real estate investment?
Sure. There are other investments. I think it all depends on the conversation that we all have. I know that Madison, for instance, has a new fund. So Madison is your debt fund, and they have another debt fund that is closing this year, another raise, so that might make sense. Intercontinental is an open-end structure, so they could accept money on a quarterly basis. Cornerstone, I believe they have a debt fund as well. I don't know if they have another value-add fund today, but the easy place that we could put more money to work is definitely with some of the current managership that we have, or we could always show you a couple of other pieces as well.
Okay.
Is that just real estate or something else?
Those are all different real estate managers. So we have three flavors of real estate right now. Cornerstone is our value-add real estate manager. Intercontinental is our core plus. And Madison is our debt structure. And as a reminder, real estate starts off as a core manager. Then you have core plus, then value-add, and then opportunistic. As you go out on the risk spectrum, you also get potentially greater returns. So amongst our three real estate components, you would expect Intercontinental, then Cornerstone, and then Madison should kind of fall in between or towards Intercontinental in terms of return stream.
Well, speaking for myself, I would consider your recommendation and go with it. You've made us over $60 million last year, and like you say, in the first quarter, we were down. We lost a ton of money. And your recommendations have been, for the last 10 years or whatever you've been here, have been tremendous.
Spot on.
On average. So I would move that we take your recommendation. And what are you talking to in dollars? So, you talking like
in terms of dollars? I don't
just to bring the Hartman and Johnson and the Lays back to where the target is of the 7.5% and the 5%.
I think we can get closer if we took $5 million from Wellington Small Cap and $5 million from Hartman Johnson. That would get both of them closer to target.
Okay. So it would basically a $10 million move into one of the three real estate funds.
Into a combination of the real estate funds, yes.
Right. Okay. Has anybody got questions or objections? Or?
Yeah. Ray, I got a question on real estate. Is it commercial real estate, or how do they spread that, David?
Yes.
You're just talking about the tech sector and what's happening relative to people working at home as a result of the health issue we've just been through. You're going to see a broader base on that, and that's going to have some impact on commercial real estate. Substantial effect on it. Are they heavy into commercial, or where's their investment base?
Sure. All of the managers are commercial only. When you say commercial, the basic four food groups of real estate are apartments, industrial, office, and retail.
Retail.
You also have things like hospitality, so primarily hotels, maybe senior assisted living, student housing. But the vast majority of commercial real estate managers are invested in the four basic food groups: apartments, industrial, office, and retail.
Yep.
The two most dangerous are office and retail right now, as you look down.
That's right. And of course, industrial and apartments have done nicely.
Yep.
The easiest one to touch on is Madison. Madison is a debt manager. So what they are doing is they're loaning money to people, developers, who for whatever reason need a gap or a bridge loan in order for them to get to completion. Most of their investments have been apartments, but there have been some industrial properties as well. And their typical term is anywhere from about 1 year to 3 years. And their interest is typically about 9 to 10% interest, with some sort of fee to get in as well as get out of the loan. So for them, they're a little bit of a different animal because it's just a debt product. Intercontinental is a core plus manager, where they do have some exposure to office. They're about 40% office. But then retail is almost non-existent for them. They're single digits. And overall, they have a core, which is more conservative piece, and then a core plus piece, which is a combination of value add as well as core. So they're a little bit further out on the risk spectrum, but their way of accessing cheaper product and making it sell at a better price is what's helped them out. And then finally, with Cornerstone, they are a value add manager, which means that they pick up property, which is a little bit hairy, but then they refurbish them and then sell them out. And they are actually more across and more diversified. What I'll say is that historically, the managers have done nicely. If you look at the longer term returns for them, here we just show you a three-year return. But the three-year return for Cornerstone was 8.9%, Intercontinental was 7.2%, and Madison was 8%. So those are annualized numbers.
Yeah,
all similar. Now, the benchmark was 4.9%, so they did very nicely relative to the benchmark.
in a lot of the real estate, especially the retail and the and office buildings, are going to be reuses. There's going to be a lot of reuse in there, and those are the guys that are going to be making the money that turn those products around, whether it's apartments or storage and a whole bunch of other things that they're doing now.
That's right.
But there's going to be a major impact on retail with what's happening in the data area and the tech area.
Yes, absolutely. So that's primarily more industrial because what you have is the Amazon effect. I don't know about you all, but every week I have at least 4 boxes waiting for me in my house.
Yeah, it's changing the whole way we do business.
Exactly. You just jump online and you order whatever you want, and lo and behold, it shows up at your house. And the reason why it could show up in your house within the next couple of days is because you have all the distribution centers, which speaks to the technology orientation you're mentioning. You need all of these warehouses that need to have high ceilings, really big dock space, close to metropolitan areas. So you are seeing a refurbishment of that. So that has been a huge trend.
They're doing robotics in that. That's going to go crazy in the next 5 years in that area. Eliminating people.
Yes, technology is unfortunately causing a redistribution of resources, and obviously some people are going to be displaced by that. But yeah, there is a lot of technology improvement, even in real estate.
Are there any other commissioners on the committee that have any questions or any thoughts one way or the other as far as David's recommendation of taking $10 million from the two funds and putting it over into the three real estate funds that we have at the present time?
I don't. No.
Yeah. No. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Chairman Sweezy, this is Commissioner Payne. I'd like to just state that I agree with you for David Lee to redistribute some of those funds. And I agree with you that he's been doing an excellent job on managing the funds. Thank you.
Ray, I agree with
Bill.
I agree with Dominic. I think that his track record is pretty good, better than mine would be. But Eric, so I have no problem with the allocation.
Okay. Could someone make a quick motion for the change of the allocation?
Second.
Okay. Any other discussion on
Ray, how quickly would this reallocation take place? I mean, is this something
have to first David and maybe John Myrtle could tell us.
Yeah,
one fund that we already have, David, you know, whatever it would take, and then I believe because we've already researched these three funds that he'll be putting the money into, there's probably not a long review, is there, John?
No, the only slowdown is the resolution is a recommendation to PP&I and it'll be approved by PP&I and the board. So we would need to get that done, and then then David can take that direction. And
that could be done in March, or I'm sorry, April? The board, next board meeting would be April.
Mr. Chair, this is Chris Dunn. John, do we have a PPI?
Don't we have a special meeting coming up? Could we do it then or not?
There's no fixed PPI meeting at this time, I don't think.
Okay.
Al, when you could call a special meeting to do this, maybe when Scott has something else over the next month or two.
That's what I'm thinking. You know, I'm just assuming that we move this
bring
along
it to
rather
whether
than
it's
let it
the
sit.
April or the May meeting, Bill, and we'll just have it on the agenda to move the recommendation.
That's only 20 days from now, or 23 days from now.
Right.
We do have, Mr. Chairman, we do have plenty of things to talk to PP&I about. One of them is what we just talked about, which is Becky Seelman giving us a presentation update on the pension calculation process and how that's going to work, and also talk about, you know, we'll bring her in to talk with David about what Commissioner Sweezy asked for, which is what our liability is, and also with the administrative increases. But we also we have plenty of things that we're going to need to talk to you about moving forward. We need to give a presentation on wellness and updates on that. So, yes, we'll schedule something, and we'll make sure we have a full agenda.
Okay, and if we can't do it this month, we'll do it by the May meeting, Bill. The May board meeting, we'll have the recommendation from PP&I to come to you, to the full board.
One thing I could add here on that, with regard to Becky's report, Becky and Milliman are preparing the GASB 74, 75, and 67, 68 reports, which we need for the audit. And once I think it's just Madison that we need a statement from for the end of December. So it's possible that those reports will be finalized in the next 30 to 60 days, which would be, you know, it would be a good point. That would be a good discussion point, because you'd have all of those numbers in one document for OPEB and pension.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. Anyone else have any questions of David?
David, can I have his number?
Yes, Commissioner. So.
Are there any members of the press on the line?
No.
Yeah, we'll send his number to you, Commissioner Patel.
Okay,
thank you. The public meeting.
Hey, David, how's your wife's money doing? That could be the real benchmark.
Well,
better be doing good in the market.
She's a teacher in New York City, so we have some portion that is a guaranteed 7% return, and then other pieces have done nicely. So thank you for asking. Yes.
All right.
Five, opportunity for general public comments.
Should be asking about his 529 plan. I've heard those kids in the background.
Commissioners, comments, questions? Motion for adjournment?
So moved.
Okay, thank you very much. Means adjourned.
Thanks,
thank you all. Appreciate it. Stay well.